Jim, you are a history nut, or at least are like my personal history nut.
Aw.
Well, it's Mike.
Thanks.
Like that, Mike. No, the thing is here. Here, I'm gonna
episode title.
My personal history nut.
I wanted it to be age appropriate porn.
Welcome to Nerd Burger, episode 19. I'm Mike.
And I'm Craig.
And here we are.
Look at that, 19. Very close to 20.
Yeah, how about that?
Not that that's a significant milestone. If we start celebrating every 10, we're going to look kind of ridiculous. Not that we don't.
We're not allowed to celebrate until 50? Is that what you're saying?
I think 26.
Why 26?
Half a year.
Oh, okay.
If we keep on the every week schedule, that'll be the 6 month point. I think 26 is acceptable, and then 1 year.
Okay,
so
agreed.
Motion carried and passed. Just skipping right past all the parliamentary procedure bullshit at the front. yeah, make sure to make a note where you got to bleep out I said a naughty word.
Can I bring you back up now?
Yes, you can.
Speaking.
We hear somebody. But we have a guest, and his name is Jim, and he's going to like this song.
The year of our Lord, 1506,
we set sail from the county of Cork.
Got to delay it.
Sailing away
with a cargo
of bricks
for the grand city hall down in New York.
Looking crap she was rigged fore and aft. Oh, all the trade winds drove her.
Okay. Bring it down. The Irish Rover. Okay. That was terrible. There's a delay, apparently, between you and us.
How about
Jim,
that?
Hi, Jim.
Hey, everybody. I could still be going. I could go.
That's okay.
Sure. All right.
We got the echo effect Irish Rover singing spot on. We don't need to do it again. One take.
Morning, everybody.
Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thanks for having me by.
And the singing thing didn't go quite as planned because of the delay that we have between us and the Skype guest.
That was planned?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, well, except the tech bit.
Except the fact that there was like a second delay. But that's because I know Jim from the Renaissance Fair from many, many years ago. And I've talked about that on the podcast a little bit. And we sang together occasionally in what was the group called, Jim?
The Bristol Ambush Singing Society. We're not ready, so why should you be?
It was a bit that we do at the end of the day when people didn't have anything else going on. Kind of everything had wrapped up and it was before closing gate. And a bunch of us, there'd be, you know, a dozen, 15 of us would get together. We'd run up to a group of patrons, sing a song at them, and then take off and go to like the next group of patrons and sing a song at them. And there was a lot of sea shanties and folk songs. Although I don't know that we ever sang Irish Rover. I just picked that one for you because it starts off strong.
Yes, and it's also one of our favorite groups, who unfortunately is no longer performing, the Corsairs. There's a huge subculture of these guys that come up and go away. Really, the only one that's left from the days when Craig and I started was the Jolly Rogers, who have now found their way onto iTunes.
Uh-oh.
Which is kind of strange. They've gone through a number of personnel iterations, but there aren't a whole lot of groups that had that sort of longevity. I suppose we've also got Wild Mountain Time and some of the others. But no, the Corsairs are dearly missed. They're a good group of guys and actually had a chance to hang out and perform with them down there years ago.
Yeah, I never met them, but I own several albums. Several CDs. Their CDs are all called the black one, the green one, the red one, and that's just the color scheme for the album.
And they actually did that because, much as we discussed in the start of the show, they just got sick and tired of trying to come up with titles.
Right.
And they realized, no, we do sea shanties. There are no themes other than the sea. And you can come up with
each album just being named a different word for the ocean.
Right. The briny deep. The ocean.
And it's hard enough to remember which song is on which one when they're named after colors. It'd be just as bad if they were named after different words for the ocean.
Right, exactly. Well, that one's on the briny deep. Well, thanks.
That one's on the album that, it's something about the sea. What's the name? Well, that's the whole Friends thing. Their episodes were always the one with blank. Just to which I find amazingly easy to remember what episodes those are, because it's like, oh yeah, that's the one where, you know, Joey did this, or the one that where Monica did that, because that's what they titled them.
They actually had a stage right after me at the Bristol when I was up there with my show partner at the time. The guy went on to play Robin Hood, actually, at Bristol. And they were gracious enough, because frankly, they're infinitely more talented than I am. They can sing harmony and stuff. And they agreed to do this bit where they came on pistols and swords drawn and threatened to take both me and my show partner hostage. And we were then rescued by the intervention of the Sea Dogs, and they went on with their set. And it wound up building their crowd and our crowd. But I was always amazed. A bunch of class guys. Always nice to hear their voices.
And remember how back in that episode, those many episodes ago, I talked about there were the good guys and the bad guys that would do the stage combat stuff? Jim's the bad guy. He's the bad guy. Or was, anyway. The top dog head bad guy. So you spent pretty much every day at Bristol wandering around. When you were out in front of people, being kind of a dick. and then when you were backstage, being an incredibly cool person.
Well, you know, thanks for saying so. On both counts. No, it's I actually did 14 years at the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Well, the really horrifying part is a bunch of really, really kind people got together on my last day. I sort of surprised everybody with my retirement.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they got together and they got me a caricature of my character, which hangs in my office at work. And I look up at it every now and again, and I realize that I left in 2002. So I'm not sure it's the fact that I did 14 years or that I've been gone for 11 that blows me away the most.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was not long after I left.
Yeah,
just
right.
Just a year or two. Because you had been doing it for many years before I even got there.
Yeah. So it was 14 years, and I did 8 as the bad guy, and in what Craig correctly calls we always called it the scripted scene, but it was just the sword fighty guys. Yeah, well, no, I mean it's that was the distinction, is that we were I did it twice. I actually fought with a sword on two occasions, and it shocked the living blazes out of everybody because it just wasn't what my character did. I was much more into yelling and pointing and threatening doom on those I opposed.
Well, it was kind of his shtick was that you had people for that.
Right.
You didn't have to pick up a weapon because you had people to do that for you.
Exactly. And I only did it twice, but those who were trained, they were the ones that were privileged at a huge site, jammed with people, to be trusted to actually swing swords in the middle of crowds.
Yeah, admittedly, stage blunted, you know, swords, but
still,
if some dumb patron comes walking into the middle
of
a fight,
metal sticks,
and it happens, because I saved somebody's life once.
Oh yeah,
when they walked into the middle of a fight with Jared swinging a quarterstaff around.
Oh my god,
and Jared was adept, let's say, with swinging a quarterstaff around really fast. And yeah, I saved a guy from getting his head taken off once.
Well,
because he just wasn't paying attention. He was like looking at the program, drinking his, you know, plastic yard of beer. And he walks into the middle of like metal and wood flying everywhere. And there's this big circle that, you know, there's all the other performers who aren't part of the fight are make this big circle and just kind of watch, make sure nobody wanders in.
How much of that yard of beer had he already finished?
I would imagine
2.5 feet.
I would imagine at least maybe, 10 yards by that point. It was probably late in the day, maybe. I don't know.
Well, we called it belling the cat because most of those guys would not be satisfied to drink from the same yard of beer.
Oh, right.
They needed to demonstrate their drinking prowess by consuming more than one. And if you saw the dude walking around with
like
four
of those
things around his neck, A, that was a sure sign for security, eyes on people, and B, and B for the spotters, oh boy, here we go. But no, Jared that was mentioned, Craig mentioned, was he is my son's godfather. Mm-hmm. And we just went out to Burlington, and he just passed his test for the highest form in his martial art. And so now he's certified to teach. And he was the guy I always tell people this story about the Bristol Fair. We would have these fights set up, and people would watch them. And I was a spotter. I was not a fighter. I was doing the same job Craig was doing, essentially. I was just looking very interested in how my guys were doing. Oh, kill him, where I'm really looking out for the guys with the beer yards. Well, Jared had this spotlight fight with my old show partner, and it was a quarterstaff fight.
Can we mention his name?
Absolutely. Greg Larson.
Greg, right.
Greg, lovely man. If you're out there, brother, keep fighting the good fight. He's still the assistant. He's still the associate fight cast director out there, although he stepped back from his Robin Hood role. And so he's out there going crazy. Well, he and Jared are, it's an amazing fight. People love to watch it. But you still got a few of the very disinterested kids who are like, oh, that's lame. It's all preset. You know, this is the age of MMA and all this. Well, Jared had a moment where he would get turned around and thrown at a tree.
Oh, yeah, that was the best. He was an acrobat.
And when he got thrown at the tree, he would run up it, straight up, flip all the way over Greg's head, and land on his feet and hit him in the back. And
Behind him.
And Greg...
That's like the Matrix.
Kind of.
And Greg was wearing a gator back, which is a stunt piece that allows this to be done without permanent damage.
It's a big plastic shell on your back.
Yeah, it makes you look like a turtle or a gator.
Absorbs the impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jared runs up this tree, lands, wails on him. I mean, you can hear it. Now, admittedly, the sound is assisted by the fact that it's wood smacking plastic. But those same kids that were standing right next to me going, lame, 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 would suddenly go, damn.
Yeah.
And it was those were the special moments, the ones where we said, oh, yeah, you're jaded. You think you've seen it. Well, now you're seeing it not on a TV, not on a movie screen. You're seeing it 10 feet from your head. You know, yeah. And that was that close and that visceral. And that was one of the great things about doing that show.
Yeah, that was during the Reign of Terror every day. Mm-hmm. Jared and Greg, usually, every so often be something a little different would happen, but they do that fight every day, every Saturday, every Sunday for 9 weeks.
Rain or shine, 100 yeah. 65 degrees or 102.
Muddy around that tree or not.
Yeah.
And that was always, And I don't think I ever saw him drop it once. I think he nailed it all the time.
Oh, yeah. No. That spot moment. And look, they practiced it till I'm sure it actually, to them, wasn't hard. But to those of us that can't even imagine running 2 feet up a tree, much less all the way up and flipping over it.
Flipping over a 6 foot tall guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And landing behind him. It was an amazing thing to watch and be part of. So, that's one of the reasons. There's a lot of reasons, but that's one of the reasons I did it for 14 years. And it's a drug. I mean, I've said doing the Ren Faire is a lot like golf. You'll never be as good at it as you want to be, and it will never love you as much as you love it.
Yeah, that's not entirely off the mark. I did fight scene stuff occasionally, but it was all fist fight stuff. I never did any weapon work. Although right. I did learn how to do some of the weapon work because I took classes out there.
Well, and that's the other thing. Where's the other place you're going to learn to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was great. I got to get my ass kicked by a girl. You know, Andrea.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, we had a fight thing that we did for about half a season. We, worked it out. She lived in Milwaukee. We worked it out. Like, it was great. We worked out the choreography on the front lawn in front of my apartment building. People watching.
What the hell are they doing?
And, not close enough to realize that we're missing with the punches. And, it's all phony.
When you lived on Prospect?
Yeah.
Busy street?
Yeah, on a busy street. And then went out there and we had to rehearse it. You had to run through it with the fight captain to make sure he had to be satisfied that you were going to be safe. And then we went out there and did it. And it was basically me picking a fight with a girl and then getting my butt kicked. It ended with a kick to the, This is only appropriate.
Well, no, there's nothing funnier than a kick to the knackers, except for the guy getting kicked in the knackers.
All right. So for those of you that would like to go back and listen to the original Ren Faire discussion.
Oh.
That was episode 11, Steam Torture Monthly. I had to look that up. I couldn't remember the name.
You've got news?
I do.
You did a little dance.
What's in the news, Mike?
Picking up where we left off last week.
Oh, we're going to rip Microsoft?
Just a little.
Hey, Jim, are you a Microsoft fan?
I am forced to be one.
Okay.
I don't know as we've had the discussion, but I'm in my day job. I'm the city clerk for the city of Milwaukee. And as a consequence, I've got about 103 computers I'm responsible for. And I tell people the minute somebody comes up with something that I can interface and support consistently other than Microsoft, I am in. until such time, I'm out.
All right. Well, you'll like this.
Here we go.
Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer has admitted that the company built too many Surface tablets, and it's not selling as many Windows devices as it wants.
Awesome.
This is from Tom Warren at The Verge. During an internal town hall event earlier this week, Ballmer and COO, Kevin Turner, both addressed the recent $900 million hit for Surface RT and the sales pace of Windows across various devices. "We built a few more devices than we could sell," admitted Ballmer when referring to the slow Surface RT sales. Microsoft recently cut the price of its Surface RT tablets by 30% worldwide, as we discussed last week.
E.T. for the Atari 2600, we're looking at you, making too many.
You need to tell me who this is that you know that bought one of these that doesn't like it. Because you won't.
The E.T. game?
No, the Surface.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Because I had person, that game.
The person who doesn't like the E.T. game is everyone who bought the E.T. game.
Surface is a coworker. You don't know him.
Okay. Ballmer and Turner reiterated in an internal meeting that the huge write-down was a price adjustment that was necessary to sell the Surface RT devices.
While awesome.
Ballmer didn't provide a sneak peek at the next Surface, we're told he confirmed new devices are currently being tested with incremental improvements. Because that's going to sell more.
Yeah, tiny little upgrades.
Yeah. Ballmer also briefly discussed the performance of Windows. Quote, "We're not selling as many Windows devices as we want to."
Jeez. Is this like from a form apology letter?
No, this is an internal meeting that that got leaked. He said, referring to phones, tablets, and PCs. The Verge reached out to Microsoft for comment on Ballmer's internal town hall, but a spokesperson refused to discuss the meeting. Shocker.
Okay, just for the record, if you are Microsoft, does no one sense the irony in pretending you're having some sort of a chummy town hall?
where everybody gets together and has juice and bars.
Right. And is there a hoedown? Are there songs from the Music Man sung? Is there a band with straw boaters and striped jackets and clarinets wailing out Dixieland? What sort of nonsense is that? I mean, seriously. I mean, people, that's absurd. You are the biggest corporation on the planet. You don't have town halls. Have your meeting. Have your memorandum. I am not going to do your hee-haw bullshit. I'm not going to do it. Ooh. I mean, no, because here's the problem. I actually get wound up about stupid business nonsense. And
apparently.
I have a wonderful deputy. I have a wonderful deputy clerk. But she is all into this business stuff. And she and I go back and forth constantly, which is one of the great things in our relationship, in that I tell her, I said, if it serves a purpose, if it makes sense, if it's moving the ball forward, fine. But these exercises for the sake of exercises, look, I'm the boss now, which is kind of weird. I just work for these 15 council members who I refer to as my benevolent overlords, and they are. But the fact of the matter is, when I was down the rung some, and I would have these meetings, and these people would come in and try to be my friend and try to be my buddy. It's like, no, you're my boss. If you want to go out and have a beer and a smoke, that's fine. But there's not going to be a town hall. This isn't a democracy. And that's really the lie in it. This isn't a democracy. Mm-hmm. Because a town hall suggests to me, we have them here in Wisconsin. And one of the great things about them is every year, every elector is entitled to come to the annual meeting and vote the budget up or down. And some of my fellow clerks get insane about this because they get their budget voted down. So I'm wondering, in this town hall, could I make a motion that we all have iPads?
Yeah.
Because I think the Surface sucks. I would like an iPad. Look, I'd like to pass a motion that we all get to admit that we all own iPads and iPhones because your Windows devices blow.
I think that might be our first editorial.
Yeah. I would imagine the one thing preventing the Microsoft employees who are in the audience of the town hall from doing that would be that they want to keep their jobs.
Yeah.
Aha.
So, yeah. Yeah, I get your point. It's not really a town hall in the traditional sense.
Yeah. Well, it sounds better, though.
It does.
That's the thing. It's like, oh, we'll call it a town hall.
It sounds like everyone gets to participate.
It sounds all West Coast and touchy-feely. And
yeah.
As opposed to the paddling session that it should have been.
where throughout the presentation, Ballmer's sweat is collected in a giant container, and at the end, you know, the people who have spoken up negatively, you know, have to come up on stage and drink from it.
Is he a sweaty guy? Is that what you're saying?
Have you not seen the video?
I don't. No, I rely on you for all my Microsoft bashing news. I don't go looking for it.
Did you not look at the picture I posted on the last episode?
I guess, I don't know.
Why don't you look at it right now?
No. I do have a little...
I'm not done.
Oh, okay. Well, let's roll.
Okay. Now, this is for you, Craig.
Okay. I'm a little afraid. Go ahead.
Did you hear the news about Apple's developer website? Got hacked.
Oh, that's nice.
Went down for 8 days. Just came back up yesterday.
Okay.
Security researcher claims to have accessed full names, Apple IDs, and user IDs of developers and non-developers. Security researcher Ibrahim Balik, it's from Turkey, gotcha, is claiming to have reported a developer center security hole just hours before the portal went down. Balik was able to access first and last names, Apple IDs, email addresses, and user IDs. From the information he showed in a YouTube video, update, the video has now been taken down, and what he described to me in an email, this is from Scott Buscemi, I'm not sure how to say that name. It's spelled the same as the actor.
Steve's brother.
Steve's brother, at 95Mac. The leak does not show any other information. He is insistent in stating he did this for security research purposes and does not plan to use the information in any malicious manner.
And everybody who ever downloaded child pornography when caught claims they were writing a book.
Sure.
He was doing research.
Doing research.
It wasn't me. It was my kid.
Yeah. They were searching for age-appropriate porn. Your child is 5. Exactly.
Oh.
But did I hear you say that they downloaded developer and non-developer names? Well, now the angry bird habits of a nation have been exposed. Yeah. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, no, I mean, none of this has been confirmed at all. And this is just what this one guy is saying. So, you know, that this happens all the time. There are these hackers that...
Mike says using dick fingers.
That, you know, they're benevolent hackers. They do this to help.
Oh, right. To point out the flaws the in the system. Holes. And yeah. You should pay me for this.
Right. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who knows what actually happened, but it's apparently all fixed now. So.
Okay. Well, good for them. One more item.
Apple is America's computer, tablet, and smartphone brand of the year.
Surprise.
Rebound.
Next piece of news. We can move on. I don't think you need to read anymore.
This is from Bill Liao. AdventureBeat.
We do a lot of pre-production planning on these names.
Bill L. AdventureBeat. It's been years since the company was Apple Computer Incorporated. They're just Apple Incorporated.
Right.
But America still loves Apple, just not only for its computers anymore. Apple has been declared America's computer brand of the year, mobile phone brand of the year, and tablet brand of the year by a Harris Interactive poll of 38,500 Americans, beating out strong competitors such as Google, Samsung, and Amazon. Quote, Americans continue to give Apple brand strong ratings. Manny Flores, an SVP, Senior Vice President at Harris Interactive, said in a statement, what really stands out is that in all three of these categories, Apple brands are measured, computer, tablet, and mobile phone. Its brand momentum scores are in the top 30 of all 1,500 brands evaluated in the study, showing that consumers see this as a brand of the year, blah, 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 blah. So they beat out in computers, HP, Dell, Sony, in tablets, Kindle, Google, Nexus, and Samsung. And HP. HP makes a tablet? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Slate? Yep. What? Never heard of it. And mobile phones, HTC, good marketing Samsung, there. And LG. No, it's another miserable failure.
Right.
Reported as news.
So, well, there you go.
Good job, Apple.
They were down. And now they're back up again. Yay.
Much like Chumbawamba.
Ooh, quick, cue it up.
I don't have that song.
Hey, they broke up. That made me sad.
A little bit of just personal news for somebody that we sort of know. The record company.
Mike? Yeah.
Uh-huh. The folks that does our opening and closing theme. They're on the big screen, sort of.
The movies?
Their song, Feel So Good, is featured in the theatrical trailer for the movie Last Vegas. Yeah, it's...
Oh, is that the one with Robert, the old... With,
it's all the yeah, old guys
Michael
going
Douglas
to...
And, yeah, okay.
Robert De Niro, Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Kline. They're all childhood friends who are going
like
to Vegas.
It's like The Hangover 30 years from now.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And it's their song. That song, their song, plays from like the 30-second to the 1 minute mark at the most during their most recent trailer. It's like
it's in the trailer.
It's in the trailer. It's the background.
Is it in the movie?
I don't know. It's in the trailer. So, congratulations, Chris and the other guys. These are people we know, Jim, not you.
That's fine. I cheer them on. Huzzah!
And Jim, do you speak other languages? You speak French at least.
Yeah, French and German.
Oh, then you're going to enjoy this. There's a little something on the web that's been floating around, and they killed it on the site that I had it before, and now I found it again, and it's only like part of the clip, but I want to play a little bit of this. It's the clip is, or the, you know, the little video is titled How German Sounds Compared to Other Languages. And it's the same word being spoken in French, English, Italian, Spanish, and then German.
In that order.
In that order, okay. Every time.
Avion.
Aeroplane.
Aero.
Avion.
Flugzeug.
Surprise.
Surprise.
Sorpresa.
Sorpresa.
Überraschung.
Papillon.
Butterfly.
Farfalla.
Mariposa.
Schmetterling.
Stilo.
Pen.
Pena.
Pluma.
Kugelschreiber.
And it goes on from there. And it's people in like what it like looks like ostensibly
traditional
garb. So yeah. The French woman has got a beret on, and the British guys are kind of like wearing an overcoat.
Is the German guy dressed like a Nazi soldier? Well,
he's in lederhosen. But it's always each of them saying, you know, Daisy. And it gets to him, and he's like, because the German language is a guttural language. Yeah. It's a rather harsh language at times. Jim.
Yes.
Say something in German.
Was willst du dir sagen auf Deutsch heute Morgen? Guten Morgen, Nürnberger. Alles geht's gut Ihnen? See, it can be lyrical and fun. No, not at all.
But it's fun to make fun of how there's like a lot of hard consonants in there. And the German, you know, the stereotypical German, angry German voice.
Well,
anyway, it's a fun video.
Hitler didn't help, right? I mean, you know, and I don't mean that merely in the global scale Holocaust genocidal lunatic way. I mean that in the sense of we've all heard snippets of his speeches.
Right, he does a lot of screaming,
and there's the screaming and the guttural and
pounding
the crazy
of the podium,
and yeah, and we're looking at that saying, well, this is the language of Goethe.
So here's the thing, though. Maybe if, you know, in the alternate history of Earth, somewhere out there, there's another, you know, parallel universe where Hitler didn't come to power, where German is considered like French as far as like the prettiness of the language. And everybody.
Exactly. I'd like to think so. If there are infinite universes, so be it.
somewhere out there, there's a universe where people say, oh, German's such a lovely tongue. Even though half their words are like words that are made up of other words to describe things.
Sure.
What's the longest German word you know?
It's German actually has the distinction of having the longest word in any alphabetic language. I can't repeat it. It's the word for their social security system, and it has 96 letters.
Wow. Now, the only really long word from a language that I don't know that I know, if that makes sense, is Hama Hama Naka Naka Apua.
I'm going to assume that's Hawaiian.
That's Hawaiian. The name of a fish.
Okay.
And yeah, hama 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 naka naka apua. That's, and I think, I don't know if that's the longest word, but it's an incredibly long word for Hawaiian that only has what, 14 letters in its alphabet, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, how's that? What language do you speak, Mike?
English, American,
American,
specifically American.
You speak Apple. I
speak Mac.
Oh, sorry. You know all the code names for all the different operating systems for everything.
Yeah. But I know that for all that other stuff too.
Okay. That's true. So that's enough about languages, I suppose. Jim, you are a history nut, or at least are like my personal history nut.
Aw.
Well, it's Mike.
Thanks.
Like that, Mike. No, the thing is, here. I'm gonna
episode title.
I'm gonna, My personal history nut.
I want it to be age appropriate porn.
We'll see what happens. But all through grade school, junior high, high school, I had all sorts of history lessons, you know, lessons and then eventually full on classes of history and everything. And never once did a history teacher instill in me the idea that history was interesting, because it was all, I mean, just constantly, you know, just memorize these names, dates, and places. Kill me. To the point that I never took a history class after high school. Never once. And then I did the Renaissance Fair.
I had to. You didn't have to in college?
In college, no. Well, you had really? To take humanities, right. But it didn't mean you had to take a history class.
No, I had to take history.
I had history of architecture. I had to take that.
Now, see, that I didn't have to take.
But anyway.
Oddly.
I got to the Renaissance Fair, and part of when you start doing that is you take some classes and kind of learn about the period so that you can speak intelligently about the Elizabethan era.
Well, yeah.
And Jim taught those things.
Okay.
I owe a lot of my, resurgence of actual interest in history to Jim, because now the reason I get into certain periods of history and actually watch documentaries and read ups on stuff and is because of you, Jim.
Oh, well, you know,
don't cry. It's not that big of a deal.
I'm kind of choked up.
Aww.
But no, I mean, I wish I could say, and this is a strange thing to say, because I respect teachers a remarkable amount. I mean, they have an incredibly difficult job, but I was in high school taking AP European History, and I was his target audience, this teacher's target audience. It's pretty tough to find someone who is more into history than I am. There are better historians than I am, but they're not more into it than I am. And
what you're saying is you're passionate about it.
Exactly. And we'll go, you know, let's get salty and let's go. But, I'm sitting in this class and this teacher is droning and I'm listening to him and I'm saying, wait a minute, I've heard this lecture before and I couldn't remember where. And I went home to my bookshelf that I had kept, my little history bookshelf that I had since I was a little kid.
Wow.
A whole
history bookshelf. Wow. Dedicated to history.
Okay. Yeah. I knew we were getting a history nerd on here today, but damn.
Was this like a floor to ceiling deal or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did it have a ladder?
My mother. No. See, that's the downside. My mother would not have trusted her physically challenged son to climb a ladder. My sainted mother. You want to go all the way. It's 1976. I'm 10. And I go to my mom and I say, could you please purchase me the bound set of the Irvin Commission that's now available? Bear in mind, there's no online, there's no store.
Right.
She has to write the Library of Congress to get me these hearing books so I can go through them. I was so fascinated by them. And I still have those, actually. And she said, so I get these, you know, these pale green bound volume of the transcripts of the Irvin Watergate Commission that I still have. So that's on that shelf that I'm talking about. And I go up there and I find this book that my mother had purchased from me at a rummage sale. And it's the College Outline Series of Modern History. And for those who don't remember, this was just supposedly a way of helping students at a different time get through college courses. Sort of like Cliff's Notes for History.
Sure.
And I pull this down and I realize this professor is reading this outline.
Oh, jeez.
Line for line. And so I go in and I talk to my buddy Pete Stoudmeyer, who's now a professor of history at Marquette, actually. He's a professor of German history, specializing in Nazism. Go figure, full circle and scene. And I tell Pete this and he's aghast. I mean, I found it humorous. He was angry.
I can imagine if that's your thing.
But here's the thing. We're sitting in this class day after day after day being bored out of our skulls, and he's not even – this dude is clearly phoning it in.
Yeah, I could read this book on my own time.
Right, and he's not
adding
anything.
And go do something
anything.
Useful
he's
with this time.
Literally reading you Cliff Notes from history.
Right, and he's – the really horrifying thing
is – And people
is,
wonder why
– That's like student's job to history. Read the Cliff Notes.
Yeah. He took the time years ago, I'm sure, to type them onto paper.
To make it look like it was his own work.
Like, right, right. So he's even...
Now that's a dedicated mind, slacker.
He's either
something
a plagiarist.
I would do.
And so what Pete and I decide to do, we decide to ask him questions based on the next item on his outline.
Oh.
So he's doing the Baroque architecture. And we go, well, sir, Mr. Smith, I'll call him. Mr. Smith, what about the Rococo? And he would look at his notes and go, oh, well, interesting you mentioned that. And we're about to discuss that now. We did this about 2 days.
So you're basically setting him up.
Yeah, and finally...
Like doing the intro for his next segment.
Right. And so finally he goes, Ozarsky, and calls my friend out, and he says, see me after class. He dismissed us. He dismissed us from the class, excused us, said we had to do one research paper and gave us an A. As long as we did not divulge his secret.
And wow. Now you've put it on the internet forever.
Oh, yeah. And bear in mind, I did not go to a cheap high school. I went to Marquette High, which is a private high school hereabouts. And I'm here to tell you that that was one of the things that made me say, as much as I respect teachers in a theory, they're individual people that are doing real harm to something I care a lot about. And it doesn't get any better when you get academics. And I have my master's in history from Marquette, and I took PhD credits at Madison. And one of the many reasons that that came to a halt was shared with me by a brilliant thought from a friend of mine who was also getting his PhD there, who said, so many academic PhDs these days, you got an individual sitting in his backyard and someone backs up a truck that's full of beans and they dump the beans into the yard and they spend 3 years and they sell their blood and they work at a bad restaurant to pay the bills while they count the beans. And then after 3 years, they're done. They've made their notes. They've counted the beans and they report in their dissertation, there are this many beans that were dumped in my backyard. Huzzah, you're a professor. Without any sense of, can you teach anybody? Can you inform? Can you excite the imagination?
Right. I can teach people how to count beans. I have a certificate.
I am a bean counting fool right over here. But that's my point. And so when I came to, and that was the thing that was so damaging, because here little 16-year-old Jimmy goes to the King Richard's Fair, King Richard's, you know, Renaissance Fair, and before it was Bristol, and sees this thing and goes, oh my God, I have to do this. This is what I want to do.
And that's because where it began.
Yeah, and these people are on fire for this. These people love this. And so when you do history in the Bristol environment, yeah, there's stupidness that goes on. There's silliness. Court of Common Pleas. You know, we'll
talk about that at some point, Mike.
Yeah, but I mean, there's so many silly things that go on. Well, heck, it took me an entire 14-year career at the Bristol Renaissance Fair to come up with the shtick, say something filthy. And it was a game show. We ran it as a game show. We sometimes had hundreds of people participating. And the premise of the show was you had to come forward and say something that was not dirty. You couldn't swear. You couldn't say something crude. You had to say something that sounded filthy. And we had it as a competition. And the last time we did it, and I will die with this memory, if memory holds, is we had 10 contestants. And I was scared to death.
That somebody was going to go up there and...
Oh, that somebody was going to drop an F-bomb or say whatever they were going to do. Because we had a huge crowd. I mean, this was hundreds of people. And Alan Vucicevic Vuce, he stands up. He's standing there with a giant stick in his hand. Okay. And
he's
I said
a prop.
Alan Vucicevic, or actually I said I think that year, Morth Ragbone, say something filthy. And he throws up his hand and he says, I have wood.
Right.
And I go down the line, and finally the last guys in line, and I got to them last on purpose, were the two Vikings who were patrons. These are guys that come in Viking costumes. They typically show up on the first day in a limousine. I do not kid. They show up in a limo. They're wearing the furs and the helmets. Their purpose is to walk around, drink, and blow their horn. Not a metaphor or a euphemism.
Right.
And
I believe I've met these people.
Yeah, you certainly have.
They've been there. Missed them, huh?
Yeah, I know. They were there, and I looked at one of the people I was in the show with, and I said, are you serious? And I went, no, let them go. Let them go. I'm like, okay. And I got their names, and I forget them now, but it was like, Snorri and Olaf.
Right.
Say something. And the crowd is shouting this, mind you. Say something filthy. And he stands up, and he goes, live and uncensored, Bush and Putin. And I fell apart. I sat down. You know, I went, damn. I went, that was the point of the show right there.
Thank you. Like, I'm out.
Seinfeld teaches. Walk away. Yeah. You're done.
Drop the mic.
Boom. Out. Hope you enjoyed it. I know you're crying. I am.
Can I?
So, go ahead.
Can I tell my favorite Vooch bit?
Sure. Because your show.
Whenever he would, he'd do it a couple times a season. Usually we didn't repeat a lot of stuff because it was all very improv-y. But every so often, Vooch would see that things were lagging, like at Court of Common Pleas or something. And he'd be like, oh, I can interject here and kind of fill the time until we get back on track. And he'd come out and he'd ask you often, would you like to see an impression? Okay. What kind of an impression? I do an elephant impression. And he'd pull out a handkerchief and stuff one corner of it into the right side of his belt and hold it out and say, that's one ear. And he'd stuff a handkerchief into the left side of his belt and pull it out and say, that's the other ear. And for the trunk, and he'd start reaching down into his pants. And by the time he had done this a few times, it was well choreographed amongst everybody else in the cast that we would all scream in unison, no! And then he'd walk off dejected because he didn't get to complete his impression.
You know, and so that's so the notion that we were some sort of a bastion of historicity is absurd. I mean, it's just not going to happen. But at the same time, there were those things there that were historical. There were great, great moments and great, great actors, actually. A gentleman who's still doing it, he's playing Sir Francis Walsingham this year, Christopher Stryker, who I'm happy to name publicly because he's a wonderful actor. He inhabited those spaces, and seeing those things there and living in those spaces there, and the people that do care about the history, if you want to see it, it's there, it's on offer, and it's in a way that gives it to you with a real humanity that so much of contemporary instruction is lacking. And you've got the Bristol Military Guild, the Guild of St. Michael's, another great, great group that's got a long history there. These people are committed to showing you a slice of history that's otherwise hard to find. Everybody's into Napoleonics and World War II. Not a whole lot of people are into that whole Elizabethan military thing.
kind of a niche.
It's actually a niche within a niche, tell you the whole truth. Because, you know, you've got military history, which has sort of been ghettoized by modern historians. And then you've got the Elizabethan military with, you know, people are going to try to figure out who Elizabeth is or who Elizabeth is, I suppose. But you know, so those guys doing that. So having that space and being in that area, it was a real joy. And you got a lot. I wish I didn't have as many people as did come up to me and say the same sorts of things that Craig did, which was to say, you know, you made history interesting. This place, you made me care about history for the first time. I had this moment of, oh, what have I done, about 5 years ago when I got a wonderful email from a young man who was in the court years ago, who said, he said, I'm finishing up my PhD I believe it was at Brown at the time, and I'm doing it because of you, because of what you did and what you showed me and what the opportunity you gave me. And I wanted to say, I've made a perfectly intelligent young man unemployable. You know, because you know, I tried...
Sorry.
No. That's what that was. So yeah. I mean, I did that, and I went. I did it, and I found out that I couldn't get work, and I had some other issues with it, and so I went on and I did other things. But I'll always love it, and I think Bristol's a great space to do it. And for the person who's looking for history, it's there. You can find it, and it's still very much alive, even though it's a place now where fantasy rules, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's part of the mix. It's part of what keeps the doors open. And man,
right? If it gets people in the door to know that they're going to do a Robin Hood thing or that there's pixies running around, and then in the process they get a chance to see the court do their thing or somebody doing a lecture. Like, I don't know if anybody has really taken up that spot that you used to do at the beginning of the day.
Right. Right.
You acclimate everybody to the period.
Well, it's interesting because
there's a great little half-hour lecture he would do with patrons at the very beginning of the day where he'd really just kind of get the point across about what Elizabethan history is and what this place is and what, you know, and what it's not.
Right. And it's interesting because I may go down. I've been talking to Greg, Greg Larson, my old show partner, and we're interested in doing our show for a couple weekends this year. But no, there really hasn't been that spot. But there have been other opportunities, and people have taken it up. And I'll tell you, that site is the you know, I don't know the last time you went, Craig, but
it's been a while.
Yeah, the front area, the area that they call the Serengeti and Watal, is
there was no trees. Now,
right. No, it was funny. I actually did one of my classes this year because I again instructed in the Bristol Academy of Performing Arts. And I was out there on the stage. It's now called the Harbor Cove stage, I think. Mm-hmm. When Craig and I were there, it was called Elizabeth's Landing, but we all called it Bessie's Broil because there were no trees, there was no shade, and they didn't even have a tarp up over. That's as close as I ever came to fainting, to falling down at the fair.
Yeah,
I remember I was standing doing my show. I was halfway through my screamy, ranty, yelly show, and the audience suddenly went green. And I realized, oh, this is how it ends. Okay.
Because you got pale and stopped sweating.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And that's the worst. That's... When you're out in hot weather and you stop sweating,
yeah,
it's over.
Yeah,
that you've already passed that line.
So no, we're out there. But if you go out there now, I mean, they have an indoor coffee shop now. They have a hookah bar.
Maybe I'll have to go now.
Yeah, I know it's absolutely crazy. So it's the fact that it's staying open and that it can still be one of the premier Renaissance fairs in the country. Arguably, it's one of the three best. And as a consequence, it opens the door and leaves the opportunity there for people to see the history, even if they're also going to see elves and pixies and fairies and Robin Hoods. I said I had this fantasy scenario worked out with Greg Larson. I said if I could ever sell him on it. The notion was Edward Cook would pursue my character, Sir Edward Cook, Attorney General to Her Majesty the Queen, would pursue Robin Hood. And he would catch him and he would throw him up on stage and he would put him in the rack and he would look at him and say, "What's your real name, son? Look, let me tell you a story. My father Thomas was the recorder of the town of Lincoln 50 years ago and he caught Robin Hood. Turned out he was a man named Tim from Devon. That just wanted to get away from his life. He ended up very, very badly on a rack and on a noose. So, what's your real name?" And the fact is, Edward Cook did chase a Robin Hood. You know, he did chase a real Robin Hood. And so finding those little nuggets of history and turning them into something that's relatable to people. I often said that Sir Edward Cook was an IRS auditor with unlimited power.
That's not terribly off the mark.
You know, he wasn't a man of violence. He didn't see the sense in it. He knew it was necessary, but it right. wasn't his thing. His whole thing was, I'm about to crawl into your life and probably into your colon, and you're not going to enjoy the experience, or you can tell me what I want to know.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, yes?
Did you want to go crazy on Game of Thrones?
Nah. I don't know if I want to. I mean, sure, I'll go. I dance for grandma.
You just mentioned something.
I mean, my whole vibe in
an email to me.
Yeah, my whole vibe is just that when you talk about the way history is portrayed, the argument I'm making is that people have a desire for history, so give them history. You know, people want real history. And find the real history. Find what's entertaining in history. Find what's exciting in history. Because I am afraid that people think that Game of Thrones is history. You know, I really am afraid. It's like, so when exactly did that dinner appear where everybody died?
Did they just change the names of everything? Because that continent looks like England.
Well, right. Exactly.
And the Starks are from Scotland up in the north.
The fact that George R.R. Martin is notionally, you know, hanging this on the peg of the Wars of the Roses is fine, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's a long tradition of that in fantasy literature. But given that we're not putting out the alternative, the better alternatives, or doing it only in very limited ways, between that and what was the other one I was thinking? I mean, you've got the ancient Roman stuff. You've got you compare it to a miniseries like Rome, which was terrifically based in history, yes, and actually could get you some good understanding of history. And it took a little more effort.
Then HBO murdered it because, oh my goodness, it's awfully expensive.
Well, right. That's the thing. It's just, and then you get into the whole Dan Brown nonsense, where this lying scumbag puts into the front piece of the Da Vinci Code, this is based on history. No, it isn't. There's no history here. Oh, okay. Italy exists. I give you that.
Have you ever watched Fargo?
Of course.
The event, it has the blurb at the front. The events, you know, based on true events or
right
something like that. And then you get to the end and it has the whole, you know, all the characters, blah, 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 fictitious, no, you know, no resemblance right. to any person, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Because it, yeah, they put it there for a fact.
Exactly. And that was the whole, and that was
the problem the, is that the problem is that that's accepted because, oh, it's a movie. They're just telling you that to make you think that for the movie. But when it's in a book, it's a lot right. more real to people.
And the next, and you know, it doesn't help us that we have the Hitler Channel, otherwise known as the History Network. Yeah.
Well, it's got the big H.
Right. It's, I think that stands for Hitler. You know, it doesn't help that they put out, you know, I turn on the History Channel and I see a show on my little channel guide, Nazis versus Aliens.
Oh, I'd watch that.
Oh, of course I did. You know, I'm not saying I wouldn't watch it, but only for the same reason I watched Sharknado.
I have it recorded. I'm going to watch it soon.
Can I come over and watch it with
no,
you?
No, you have Saw movies to watch.
We need to do a show on Sharknado.
So you do know, episode. By the way, yeah. Craig, you do know that we have a tie to Asylum, the show, that the producers of that show.
Eric Forsberg. Well.
That is correct.
Yes, Eric Forsberg, who performed at the Renaissance Fair, has written and directed a number of movies for Asylum, the company that made Sharknado.
Including the most important of them, Mega Piranha.
Is that the one that's got, like...
It's got a Mega Piranha.
No, but wasn't...
One of them had, like...
Did he did one of the ones
Debbie
that had, like,
Gibson
Debbie
and
Gibson
Tiffany.
And Tiffany in it.
That is Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, correct.
Yes.
And a Mega Piranha.
I know. I remember flipping through Netflix, and I was like, Eric Forsberg? I know an Eric Forsberg.
That is him. Yeah, no. And he and I have actually been in touch. He and I have actually had a tangential conversation about me coming down to Belize to be the bad guy for Mega Piranha 2.
Nice.
And I will buy that movie.
No, I said to him, I said, yeah, that would probably be the move where my bosses, the alderman, would say, yeah, you can go to Belize for 6 weeks and shoot a Mega Piranha movie. But yeah, I mean, if you want to go off on Game of Thrones, that'd be cool.
Well, I don't really have a lot to go off on. You made a comment in the email about how people think it's real.
If that's what you want to do, I'll go on a wind.
Well, you got something that you can go nuts about that's only going to take a few minutes because we're kind of getting close to the end here.
No. I mean, okay, here's the point where he admits I didn't know we were recording.
Oh, yeah, we're back on the... This is the podcast, man.
I don't got a light over here telling me what's going on. Wow.
That's okay. It's good stuff.
No. So just to summarize it then, since we are running short on time, there's this thing about when you create a historical document, and I don't want this to come off as there must only be historical pieces. This is the only thing that must be discovered and discussed. You know, that's all well and good. That's all well and fine. But I don't mind the fantasy piece. I'm worried that because there is a lack of patience with history, or because there's a perception of history being a certain way, that nobody wants even to take the risk.
If the Sharknado only actually killed 112 people in real life, then that's all the number of people that can die in the movie.
Look, I have right? I have a Mega Piranha T-shirt, and
of
I tell you,
you do.
It made me the cool guy at Gen Con. This was 2 years ago when Gen Con screwed up the lines. They screwed up Will Call. You may recall.
And, yes, we ran into each other on the floor, and
yes, we did.
Talked about that briefly because
my wait was something on the order of 2 hours, 3 hours. To get to Will Call at the start of the day, and I thought I was salted away, but I was wearing my Mega Piranha T-shirt like you do, and there were people coming up to me going, "Dude, where'd you get the sweet shirt?" So I take second to none in my love of Sharknado and Mega Piranha, and Eric Forsberg's partner in the Puritan venture. He was the Puritan at the Renaissance Fair. His partner Maurice.
Those two guys walked around basically telling everybody that they were damned for whatever. You know, they just make stuff up.
Threatening to burn them and all that. But his partner, Maurice McNicholas, is also, it's funny, he's classically educated. He's, you know, he speaks Gaelic and Greek and Latin and all this. And he works at the Cook County. He too is a government flunky like I am. And he he actually has appeared in a number of movies. He actually was in The Untouchables, that TV series that aired on Fox for some time.
Okay.
And but now he's in Pickman's Muse, one of the Lovecraft pieces. And so he's got that. So I take second to none in my love of these off Hollywood shows and all these other things. But when it comes down to trying to do history, I just urge the pop culture, just give it a chance. You know, let it be funny, let it be scary, let it be romantic. And I would hold up Rome as the example. You want sex? Oh my God. I mean, you know, you want violence? They got it in boatloads. And yes, they created some fictional characters, but the portrayals of Mark Antony and Augustus and Cicero and some of the others are among the best you'll see on film. They didn't have to be faked. They didn't have to be forged. Yes, they had to be well-written. I'll stipulate to that. But there was a real history to them, and they're awesome and should be seen. And those stories, there are so many stories. I mean, there's 10,000 years of recorded human history, and we've told such a tiny fraction of them. So hopefully we can see some more told.
I have to ask now, have you ever seen The Tudors?
I have.
The Showtime series?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't...
Outside of it being essentially a soap opera.
Right. And Henry's life is... Henry VIII's life is a sordid soap opera. I mean, he's one of the first... I mean, he's among the first. I don't think he's the first. He's among the first recorded cases of syphilis in Europe.
Because, he liked to...
Yeah, yeah. And
a lot.
I am particularly glad that they show him as a young man, because I think the image a lot of people have of Henry VIII, at least in my generation, is of Charles Laughton, you know, heavy.
The big dude.
Right. Fat. And he was. He was all those things. He was fat.
That all came about because he sustained a horrible injury.
Right.
And couldn't exercise the way he did when he was younger.
Right.
And so then he got big.
And he also never stopped eating. And, you know, he was a glutton.
So the rich people are usually fat throughout history.
Because
they got the food.
and so I am glad that they portrayed this other Henry. It's overdrawn. But that goes to the writing, and that's not a historical criticism.
I've actually watched the entire thing, and I'm barely the scholar on the Tudor dynasty, but they tweaked things for some dramatic effect, and it was very soap opera-y. But it was pretty solidly historical. I mean, they hit on a lot of stuff that really spoke to what Henry's life was all about, and his split with the Catholic Church, and how long the reasoning behind all of that, and ultimately his waging war, and because he had this overriding urge to make sure that he went down in the history books for something. He didn't realize he was going to go down in the history books for splitting from the Catholic Church.
But you're right, and I have seen that episode.
And they play that out very much. It's like he hangs a lampshade on it and says, I want to be remembered for this. This is going to be my opus.
Right. And that they make that split more complicated than it is. I mean, look, there are history books written from then to now that show much less subtlety than that show showed. So to that, they right. deserve great credit. And the notion that they showed it as a human thing, as a complicated thing, as a textured thing, that alone, that I'll absolutely give them. That they get a lot of credit for that.
And it's got lots of pretty, pretty people in pretty, pretty costumes.
Yes.
The wife made me watch Shakespeare in Love.
Okay.
Recently. Now, I know the whole story is fabricated, but as far as like the actual accuracy of
some of the historical
speech and
figures.
The dress and the, the way they presented.
Not terribly far off.
England.
Yeah.
Because he had a pretty sweet blue leather jacket that he wore the whole time. And I turned to Allison and I said, "That's a pretty sweet blue leather jacket Shakespeare's wearing." I'm like, "That's not period accurate, is it?" And she's like, "Neither are his boots."
Nice. There's one of ours.
My wife has a degree in literature. So.
Nice. Well, we actually, at the Renaissance Fair, the year after that show came out, the character playing Shakespeare got that blue leather jacket.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We threw that right on him.
Oh, and he became incredibly popular out at the fair.
Yeah. And look, he's a good-looking dude. Okay.
Jeff.
Yeah, yeah. He's an excellent-looking dude as it was, but you threw that on him, and everybody went, "Oh, it's Shakespeare," and he can do the poetry. He's done Shakespeare
on the
stage.
That was the thing, too, because not only did you get the people that would come after him just to, kind of interact with Shakespeare, because he kind of looked a little bit like the guy from the thing, and he had the right costume and the whole thing. Dude knew Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So even the a-holes who came out there to try to stump him, got their asses handed to them.
Yes.
Which was always fun to watch, because you see somebody that's like, oh, you're Shakespeare, huh? How about, and they start reciting something from Titus Andronicus.
Yeah, and that was,
and you know, or some awesome really obscure sonnet, and, you know, he'd finish the line for him.
Yeah. My favorite part in the whole movie was, you know, they have the, anytime the queen shows up, you know, the women all curtsy, and then the men do this thing with them. You know,
the reverence.
Is that what that's called?
That's what we called it at Bristol.
Okay. They do, they do the
that's what it's called. That's what it's called.
And, okay. So, right. Gwyneth Paltrow is, pretending to be a guy dressed up as a girl to act in the play because the women aren't allowed to act. And the queen, you know, the queen's army guy shows up to arrest her. And then the queen has to step in and be like, no, clearly that's just a guy dressed up like a girl. albeit, you know, it's really good. The makeup and the hair and everything, that you guys did a really good job, but clearly that's a man. And she calls him to step forward, and she, or her, and she uses her fake name that she's using, Master whatever, Thomas something or other. Mm-hmm. And Gwyneth Paltrow steps forward and then curtsies, and then the queen just shoots her this look like, come on.
Really?
Really? And she's like, oh yeah. And then she does the reverence. And I just thought that was pretty funny. Just the look on it was a Judy Dench's
Judy
face.
Dench, yeah.
Like, really? I'm trying to help you out here. Yeah.
Oh, we have a sound effect vault somewhere. Outstanding. I was talking about the costume folks. I was in the Evanston July 4th parade with my wife and the Bristol folks. That was when they actually gave me a horse to hold, and I told them that was a shockingly bad idea. One of the jousters handed me the reins of his horse and said, just hold on to him. And he was about 10 feet in front of a gold Camaro. And I looked at him and said, Bill, his name was Bill the jouster. I said, Bill, I swear to God, if it backs up and kicks in the window, I am not at default. I am not default. But while I'm in this parade, I look over and I see there's a bunch of those Civil War reenactors sitting there too. Mm-hmm. And I look over at him and said, gentlemen. And he looks up, and one of them, I still, to this day, he had that face, that classic Civil War face, little leathery, big mustache, little soul patch, hat, and he looked at me and said in an accent, boots are wrong.
Yeah. Bag is full of douche. That's my response.
And I think he thought it was this kind comment, because perhaps that's how they speak in their tribe.
Sure.
But I was like, Billy, is that hello for you? Is that what passes as greetings? Good time of day. Boots are wrong.
Just all part and parcel.
Yeah, just the fourth sentence.
All right. I think we're out of time now.
We're going to wrap her up.
Jim, thank you.
Oh, it's been great to be here. Like the show. Like, as I told Craig, I had a chance to listen to a couple, including Vooch's, and it was a lot of fun, a lot of success
listened,
out there.
Yes, actually, Jim listened, is a special guest who listened to, I believe, two episodes?
Correct.
Which I have gone back and reviewed that. He is the special guest. We've had four. He is the special guest who has listened to more episodes than all of the other special guests combined.
Well, if you would do me the courtesy of letting me know if anyone approaches my record, I will listen to a third episode.
That's high praise.
And only then.
Yes. All right. Mike, where can they find us?
NerdBurgerShow.com, at NerdBurgerShow on the Twitters, NerdBurgerShow on Facebook, and please email us, NerdBurgerShow@gmail.com.
And give us a review on iTunes. Be nice.
If you did can. I tell you that I identified the second reviewer?
Oh, okay. Is it somebody we know?
Yes.
Still not sure if we're actually reaching anybody beyond like friends and family right now.
Thanks, Larry.
All right. On the next episode of Nerd Burger, Mike and Craig will sing the entirety of The Irish Rover and Morning Glory and Strike the Bell and Holloway and Leaving for Liverpool and Old Maui and Ramblin' Sailor and Barrett's Privateers and Spanish Ladies and High Barbary and Santo Ano and the Mingalay Boat Song, my personal favorite.
Can I be a half second off of you?
Sure.
Cool. Bye.
Bye-bye.